The views and opinions expressed on this show are purely the views and opinions of the person who made them, and do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the show's commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. As the restriction on our God-given right to free speech manifests itself throughout the world, we are inspired by Jesus Christ's immortal words, "And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." And we reserve the rights to all our words. Thank you, and now enjoy the show.
To learn who rules over you, simply find out who you are not allowed to criticise. You are listening to ACH. I'm Andy, your host. Good morning and welcome to today's episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents, originally recorded and broadcast on Friday, September the 4th, 2026 at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. Today's episode is entitled The Films of Martin Scorsese. The time is 8:06 over here in London, England, and it is nice to be presenting new content for you again. Okay, so we're going to go over to the Martin Scorsese Wikipedia page, and we're going to scroll down to the filmography section. There is a more extensive section, but we're just going to stay on the directed narrative features, which is included in his personal page here on Wikipedia, and work through, starting with 1967. So his first film, Who's That Knocking at My Door, is kind of like a student-y type of effort. It was one of those things that would be filmed a bit when he got a bit of money, and then they'd film a bit more, that sort of thing. It stars Harvey Keitel. It's not something that ever interested me. What basically happened is, over a period of time, I found I'd watch more and more of Martin Scorsese's films, and then the ones I wasn't interested in, I'd see like in a charity shop for a pound or something. It's stupid not to just pick it up and have a look at it, do you know what I mean? And suddenly there was only a handful I hadn't seen, so I thought, well, I'll go and watch the handful I hadn't seen. This is one of the handful I hadn't seen. Part of it is that when I used to look it up, when I was getting close to seeing them all, this is the sort of thing that secondhand you'll find for £18-20, and you think, well, I'm probably not going to like it, I don't want to spend that. If I pick it up cheap, then I'll watch it. But I found if you keep going on to some of these auction sites, then the prices can fluctuate wildly. It just takes... What I've noticed is some of the sellers on there, I was told years ago by a rare record dealer that I work for, that some of the big sellers on the auction sites, they've got programs that monitor all the products on their auction site to see if anybody goes under them in price, and then they'll automatically reduce it by like a penny. I'm not sure if that's true or not, but it just makes sure that they're always kept the cheapest. So if suddenly someone comes in who you might not necessarily find near the top of the listing, because we know these listings are, you know, it may be different on auction sites, but certainly if you put the name of someone that they don't like into Google and they've got a website, that should appear at the top because that's the official website of the person you put the name in. But that's all been changed because they don't want you to go there. And I'm not sure if auction sites prioritise big sellers over the smaller ones. But I've been on to auction sites one day, found something £17, the next day it's like £6, and two or three people are offering it, so it just takes someone to go in and offer it at a lower amount, and then you can find it. So it's well worth monitoring these if there's a product that you're after and not jumping necessarily straight away. But going back to the film Who's That Knocking at My Door, paid about £5 for it, something like that in the end. It's Harvey Keitel. He hangs around with his friends. They struggle sort of talking to women. There's a scene where it appears that they've, you know, hired some prostitutes for an evening, stuff like that. And he ends up meeting a girl, and she's quite happy to, you know, have a full relationship with him, but he prefers for her to stay a virgin because he's thinking of marrying her and he's a Catholic. And then something happens that he can't take. She reveals something about his past. I don't want to go into everything here because if you want to see it, I don't want to be a spoiler. But essentially, that's kind of where things all come to a head and what have you. It's, when you look at it, the version I got was a BFI version, British Film Institute, and they'll come out and put films out, and there's a little booklet in there all about it and stuff like that. If it was directed by anyone other than Martin Scorsese, if it was some unknown guy out there, it would never have gotten the release. But because it's like him, it's regarded as an interesting point of like his first proper feature film. And when you see what he went on to do with his career, he's proved to be one of the most popular directors in the history of cinema, and still going today, but we'll get to that later on. Then that's why I got the release. Still pleased I saw it. Not sure if I'll be seeing it again. We move on to 1972, so there's a big gap here. Boxcar Bertha. Now that film was not a Scorsese, I don't believe he was involved in the writing of it. It was a Roger Corman film. I spoke about how Roger Corman, many of these directors would come through Roger Corman. You can find a film called Dementia 13 from 1963 on YouTube, which was Francis Ford Coppola's first film, and it was for Roger Corman. And I was even listening to something the other day, or watching it, and there were claims that Roger Corman would put posters out about a prospective film first that he hadn't even done anything with yet to see how they were received. And if they were well received, then he'd do the film around the poster. You know what I mean? So it was like a film factory. They'd be producing a film every month, or maybe even more frequently than that. It was really a operation going on there, and many people had their start there. And this really, Martin Scorsese had one of the Carradines in it, and Barbara Hershey was the lead actress. And it's all about a gang of hoodlums, if you like, in the 1920s, 30s, something like that. I think it seems to be Model T Fords running around, who travel around the railroads on the boxcars and commit robberies. And there are some scenes in there that are very much like Scorsese, quite bloody. There's a scene where somebody is nailed to a boxcar carriage, something like that, which isn't very pleasant to watch. These sorts of things I always find that I'm looking away at, but it gives you an indication of what he would go on to do. He ended up having a conversation with another director called John Cassavetes, who is Michael Imperioli on his Talking Sopranos broadcast with Steve Sciarrippa, said that he's his favourite director. I've looked at his list of films. I'm not a big fan. He acted as what I've seen. I've not actually seen one, but nothing that he's done a film of. I've looked at it and thought, I'd really be interested to see that. What people may know him from is he played the lead male role in Rosemary's Baby, the husband of Mia Farrow, which is a horror film without horror that I thought was a bit odd. But anyway, he was friends with Martin Scorsese, and he said to him, according to Martin Scorsese, you know, you spent a year or what have you making this film, and it's a piece of shit. And that was the quote. He said, there's nothing like wrong with it, but you're capable of so much more. You need to go and do your own film, not just go in somewhere, be employed to direct, and then, you know, churn something out. And so that led us on to, from 1972 to 1973, when he released Mean Streets, which was his first film with Robert De Niro, and it's regarded as a classic since. Essentially, the story here, again, you've got a character that played by Harvey Keitel, who's very similar to the one he portrayed in Who's That Knocking at My Door? He's a guy on, you know, who gets involved in bits of, yeah, the underside of society, if you like. He's a youngster, he maybe does a bit of gambling, and they're going to bars. And interestingly, there's a feature, an original feature, I think it's only about 7 minutes on the Mean Streets DVD, where Martin Scorsese is walking around with a couple of old school friends, and he said the film was based on them. And he's not saying that you know, one of them got shot and things like that in the end, as happens in this film, and things like that. And there's all this sort of violence. But he hung around in those circles in that area. And consequently, he recounts the story of how he was going to, him and some friends were going to be going out with some people in a car one night, or they were going to be going out in a car, and they didn't, and that car ended up being shot up, and if they'd have been there, they'd have been killed, that sort of thing. And so that gave influences to the film. And as I say, it's very highly regarded today, but I'm not one of these people that think it's anything to really write home about, to be quite honest with you. I've found it interesting to watch. I've only seen it really a couple of times. It's not something I've ever really wanted to go back to that often, but it is regarded as a classic. And many people, for me, looking at Boxcar Bertha and Who's That Knocking at My Door and reading the descriptions on Wikipedia, I was never interested in going beyond Mean Streets, further back rather than Mean Streets in his career, to see those two films. It was just, you know, filling up the set, if you like, that caused me to do so. That takes us on to Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which was essentially an Ellen Burstyn film. I think that's her name. Is it Burstyn or Bernstein? Burstyn. I got it right first time. So she was involved with this project. And what it is she's a woman, it's called a romantic comedy, and she's a woman, her husband dies, and she ends up travelling across America with her son, trying to find work and all this sort of stuff, and what gets up to her on the way. It's very, when I look at a description like that, I'm not really interested in seeing something like that. But that's the background to the film. What I found out more, because there's an extra on the DVD, in which only her and the lead male actor, Kris Kristofferson, are interviewed. There's no Martin Scorsese interview on it, although he does provide some commentary track. It was very much her project, and she was even asked if she wanted to direct it. Now, I know the name Ellen Burstyn, and all I could think of her from was, I believe she played the mother in the film Requiem for a Dream, which would have been about 25 years after this, in the late 90s, early 2000s. This was 1974. But actually, she was the mother in The Exorcist. I was, oh, wow, yeah. So she was a big name. And as I say, they talked about her even directing it, and she didn't want to do that. And then they mentioned this up-and-coming director who'd done this film called Mean Streets. Would you like to see it? And she saw it, and she thought it was great. And so they ended up doing it. And he came in. It was his first proper, you know, big budget studio type of thing that he did. I'm on the page now. Let's see. It was a 1.8 million budget in 1974, and it made 18.6 million. So it made just over 10 times what was invested. So you can't argue with that. It's not quite as bad as I thought. There's a scene that Harvey Keitel comes in as someone who becomes a lover for a while, and he turns out to be absolutely psychotic at one point. And her reaction, she said, was actually her reaction in the scene, because he was so over the top. That was what he was playing. He did the role well, but it was not quite what she was expecting, that it would be that violent and that threatening. And she had to sit down and cry for a couple of hours afterwards, I think she was saying. Not that she held anything against him. She thought he did a good job, and he certainly did. But it was probably the best scene of the film, very unpleasant to look at. And it's an interesting story. So it's one that I watched all the way through, and we'll get to that in a minute, because some of these films I don't end up watching all the way through, but that one I did. And it's worth a watch. I'm just not sure I'll be watching it again. And now we move on to one of the Scorsese classics. People always talk about Taxi Driver when it comes to Scorsese. This is 1976. Robert De Niro plays a guy who becomes a taxi driver. He's somewhat of a loner. And he wants to be a somebody. And first he thinks he... And he's got a very strange... It's almost like something about him just doesn't click. So he meets a girl that he is attracted to. She's part of a fundraising or promotional committee for someone wanting to become a senator, I believe. And he takes her out and he wants to take her to a film, and he takes her to a porno cinema, you know, for like a first date. And she ends up running off and he can't understand it. He says, well, you know, I take loads of couples in my cab to these things. What's the problem? And he just can't cotton on. There's something in his brain that's missing, that doesn't understand. That's not the sort of thing that you do. And there's a... He gradually just becomes, I say, somebody wants to be a somebody. That's all I can think of. And he decides first that he's going to try and kill the senator that this woman works for. Not because he's got anything against her, but because he wants to, you know, be a somebody like a Lee Harvey Oswald or a Sirhan Sirhan. And we won't get into whether they did it or not, but let's just say they did for the purposes of the Robert De Niro character here. And then he switches his attention to rescuing a prostitute who's played by Jodie Foster, who incidentally is also in Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, from her pimp Harvey Keitel, who dons a long-haired wig. I imagine, presume it's a wig here. I've never seen him with long hair in anything else as this pimp. And it concludes how it concludes. There's a very famous scene at the end, which there's a big shootout, and very violent. And at the time, it was considered too much for cinema. So what happened was it was very bloody. And the scene, they did something called desaturation. I believe that's what it's called, where they take the sharpness of the colours out, the deepness of the colours. So what's blood red, that's very shiny and bright red, is suddenly like a dark browny red colour. And if you look at a lot of these films from like the 70s, these low budget horror and stuff like that, that's how they tend to look anyway. The problem was they did it to the negative, or whatever they did it to. It can't be. I mean, maybe it could be now. The documentary or commentary or whatever I've seen on it is probably going back 15, 20 years, something like that. And with all these advances now, they could probably get it there. But it would still be an element of guessing how it should be, I would imagine. But it was permanently left desaturated, so that final scene never looked as dramatic as it did if you were one of the people who saw it in the cinema before it was desaturated, before it was, you know, basically it was shown a few times, probably just to a few critics and things like that before general release. But that's the story there. It's worth watching, but it's not the thing that I go back to again and again and again like so many other people do. This takes us on to New York, New York. I'm hovering over it here on the Wikipedia page. It says, New York, New York is a 1977 American musical romantic comedy film directed by Martin Scorsese from a screenplay by Earl Mac Rauch and Mardik Martin. So it goes on like that. I'm pleased I did this because it made me remember something from the film. The song New York, New York, I always thought was one of Frank Sinatra's classic songs, but it was originally recorded for this film, not by him, but by someone else. And he recorded his version, which became the pick, you know, song that people know it for. But the film itself, it's Robert De Niro and Liza Minnelli. And Liza Minnelli plays a very good singer, and Robert De Niro plays a very good jazz saxophonist. And they're both chasing their dream, but Robert De Niro is chasing it to the extent that he has to be the best, and he gets very offended. He ends up partnering up with this Liza Minnelli character, and he gets very offended that her success dwarfs his. And they have a child together, and he behaves very badly. And it was while I was watching this film, and this was one that I fast-forwarded through. I don't like musicals, so when it came to any musical numbers, I just fast-forwarded through those, and I was really just concentrating on the scenes with De Niro. And while I was watching it, I thought to myself, has De Niro ever played a likeable character in any film? I mean, all his characters, I can't think of one. Maybe there's something that I'm missing somewhere, but there's never like a kind of superhero that you want to emulate with De Niro. There's always something about his characters that just aren't right. And I got that feeling when I was watching that film for some reason that I hadn't had before. That takes us on to one of the other classics. Well, actually, no, we're going to pause for a moment because after New York, New York, it's not in this directed narrative features section on the Martin Scorsese filmography page, but it is on the full filmography, which is on a separate page. In 1978, he did a film called, I've got it in my hand here, The Last Waltz. And it's, let me say on the back of it, it started as a concert, it became a celebration. Join an unparalleled lineup of rock superstars as they celebrate the band's historic 1976 farewell performance. And it's described as the finest of all rock music by Newsweek, and also the best rock movie ever made by Rolling Stone. And what happened was the band were filming, they were doing their final concert, someone gave the idea of them to film it. One thing led to another, and they got Scorsese to do it. And Robbie Robertson from the band ended up as a musical consultant on many of Martin Scorsese's pictures, films, we call them over here in the UK. Excuse me, I'm struggling with my throat today. He was a musical consultant. He died not so long ago, and I believe it was Killers of the Flower Moon was dedicated to him, which was Scorsese's last film, we'll get on to later in the show. It's worth watching again, and there's some interesting things. I mean, the people that appear in it alongside the band are Bob Dylan, Eric Clapton, Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, Neil Diamond, Emmylou Harris, Muddy Waters, The Staples, Ringo Starr, Ron Wood, Dr. John, Paul Butterfield and Ronnie Hawkins. They're the people that are listed here. And there's an interesting look from Neil Young, one of awe, when Bob Dylan comes on, that he's really sort of can't believe he's on the same stage as Bob Dylan. So it's interesting in its way, but again, it's one of those things that you watch the songs that you're interested in and maybe don't bother with the ones that you aren't. But that would be on the other Scorsese page under documentary features. So that he did in 1978. But from the features point of view, from 1977 New York, New York, and then we had that in 78, I'm not aware of anything else he did until 1980 when he did Raging Bull. There's talk about him having a cocaine problem during the filming of New York, New York. It's not something that he's referenced that I can recall, but it has been pointed out. But whether that's true or not, I don't know. But there is a gap here. So Raging Bull is 1980, and that is what many people would regard as Martin Scorsese's best film. And it's about the boxer Jake LaMotta. And Jake LaMotta was a very sort of colourful boxer, if you like. But he also had a very turbulent personal life. He'd been married several times. And much of the film is taken up with his boxing as with his personal life. And he wrote a book about his experiences. De Niro read it, wanted Scorsese to do it for many years. Scorsese agreed to. Then the film was shot. Scorsese's editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, was going out with a guy, Michael someone or other. I think she was married to him at the time. He was from the British film industry. I think he'd been a director. And he pointed out how something looked wrong in the film, and it was the red on De Niro's gloves, boxing gloves. And Scorsese saw it and said, yeah, I've got to make it black and white. And that's why the film apparently is in black and white. I was told by someone else that he wanted to retain the film in its natural state, and that's black and white. It's all set around that time, the sort of 40s, stuff like that. So you would see it as more of a, the films around that time are black and white. So if you went to look back at boxing footage of that time, it would be in black and white. So there could be all those different reasons for it. That's just what I know. But essentially, it is a very good film. There's some notable appearances. It's the first time that Joe Pesci and Frank Vincent would appear with in a Scorsese film with De Niro, and they would come back for other films as well. And they were seen together in a film, I forget its name, by De Niro, and he was so impressed by the way they acted in that film that he suggested them to Martin Scorsese, and that was kind of what launched their career. But Jake LaMotta, if you get the Raging Bull DVD, it's one of these ones where I think you can get a double disc set because it's a very well-respected film. And he behaves appallingly towards his brother, towards his wife in the film. And he recounts taking, reconciling with his wife and getting her to watch the film with him. And he said to her afterwards, "Was I really that bad?" And she said, "No, you were worse." And funnily enough, Jake LaMotta, he went on, when you hear about these stories, because he was known to have a head like rock. And there was one point where he had to throw a fight, and he just let the other guy keep hitting him and hitting him. And he just said, "You couldn't put me down. You couldn't put me down." He's covered in blood and he just didn't go down. But he lived till his 90s. So you hear all these stories about people, you know, getting head injuries from heading a football. And you would think it's probably a lot worse to be repeatedly punched in the head. And he went on to that age. I'm not suggesting that people, you know, don't suffer, excuse me, long-term damage by doing things like that. I just find it amazing that this guy could live to that long, having been involved in not just boxing, but the amount of hits that he was known for taking. But very good film, very well done. And yeah, just not one that I go back to again and again, but if you haven't seen it, you've missed a treat. 1982 is The King of Comedy. Was one that never gripped me. I remember Danny Baker, the UK journalist, saying that it was his favourite De Niro film. I'm not sure if it was his favourite Martin Scorsese film. What basically happens in it is De Niro wants to be a comedian, and he idolises a character played by Jerry Lee Lewis, who has a show, I think it's a nightly show, something like that in America, and he comes on, does his comedy and all that sort of stuff, and he pretends that he's him to that extent. And it gets to the stage where he just keeps harassing this guy, and he won't leave this guy alone. The guy's trying to be polite to him, and it just all gets out of control. And what I found interesting about this film after seeing it again is the message behind it. And it's one that I hadn't thought about before, but Martin Scorsese explains it on an additional feature on the DVD. He said, look, you get these people when you're famous, and they want to talk to you because you've done this, you've done that, and but do they, some of them, do they really want to talk to you, or do they want to be you? He said the idea of this film is Robert De Niro doesn't admire Jerry Lee Lewis. He likes himself. He's jealous of him. He wants to be that comedian with that show on a nightly basis, going out, getting that adulation from the crowd. And if he has to kill the guy in order to be him, he'll do it. And he said, to that extent, the character that De Niro plays in this film is even more dangerous than the character of Travis Bickle in Taxi Driver. Because he'll stop at nothing to get the fame that he so desires. And it made me think, because years ago, I think the album came out 89 or 90, so I would have been 16 years old at least. And I was in Notting Hill Gate, and there's these different shops there, Music and Video Exchange, Record and Tape Exchange, and they had one for like hi-fi gear. And I was in there for some reason. And there was a guy at the counter, and he asked if they had any ghetto blasters. And then he wandered off. And the two guys behind the counter, one said to the other, "Do you know who that was?" The other said, "No." He said, "That was Brian Eno." And now, at that time, my first Brian Eno album I had, it was called Wrong Way Up by Brian Eno and John Cale. And so I ended up sort of following him around, and he must have realised that I was sort of following him. And at some point, I just shouted, "Brian, Brian." And I think the third thing, he suddenly just stopped. And he turned around and went up to him and said, I just want to say I really, really enjoyed that Eno Cale album. It's like amazing. And obviously I was like some spotty young kid. And he just looked at me, oh, right. And I just looked at him and I just ran off down the underground. I didn't know what to say. And it sounded the way it was almost like, what do you want to ask me? And I was just, what did I do it for? Do you know what I mean? And I think that there are people out there that you know, want that fame so much and they'll go to any lengths, and you just have to look at the sort of things people are prepared to do on the internet and reality TV, these sort of things these days, that this was a film that was very fortuitous of what was coming in the future. And so for me, the idea behind it was more interesting than its execution. And if you know the idea behind it, it's actually better you know it now when watching the film than you find out about after watching it. So that's a kind of spoiler I think is worth giving you. After Hours is the next film, 1985. Now, this is described as a comedy. And I'm pleased it's described as a comedy, because if it wasn't, I wouldn't have known, because I didn't laugh once. Now this, fortunately, I didn't have to buy, because it's on YouTube. So I sat here last Saturday watching it on the computer screen, which I don't enjoy doing, but it was the only way I could see it. So it stars Griffin Dunne in the lead role, and I'd not heard of him before, but he had the lead role in American Werewolf in London. He was the one who turned into the werewolf, I believe. And it's like a farce. He goes to meet a girl. He meets a girl in probably early hours of the morning when he's having a coffee at some diner in New York. And she subsequently asks him to call her. He calls her, and then all these mishaps he has when he meets up with her, and then after he meets up with her, and all he's doing is trying to get home. And it's all the farcical things that happen to him in the early hours of the morning, hence the title After Hours. So this is one that I wouldn't recommend bothering with. That takes us on to 1986's The Colour of Money, which is Tom Cruise and Paul Newman. And it's a sequel to the Paul Newman film The Hustler, apparently. I couldn't get on with it at all. I didn't find the idea of watching people playing Paul throughout a film as to be of any interest whatsoever. So I bore with it for a while. I think that is bore with it. The past tense of bear with it. It's certainly a double meaning for me here, because I did find it quite boring and I fast forwarded through a lot of it. And that's really it. I mean, it's just them going from pool hall to pool hall, and not a great deal happens. So we'll skip past that one to 1988's The Last Temptation of Christ. Now, here I'm going to go to the Wikipedia description, because I watched it all the way through. I felt I had to watch it because of the controversy that it generated. Dr. Peter Hammond knows more about it than I do. He covered it on a recent show that we did. I don't believe it's any longer on the website. Would have fallen off for a while ago. It would be in the description of one of the shows that we did together. But here's the first couple of paragraphs from the Wikipedia page on the film. The Last Temptation of Christ is a 1988 epic religious drama film directed by Martin Scorsese. Written by Paul Schrader with uncredited rewrites from Scorsese and Jay Cox, it is an adaptation of Nikos Kazantzakis' controversial 1955 novel of the same name. The film, starring Willem Dafoe, Harvey Keitel, Barbara Hershey, Andre Gregory, Harry Dean Stanton and David Bowie, was shot entirely in Morocco. The film depicts the life of Jesus Christ and his struggle with various forms of temptation, including fear, doubt, depression, reluctance, and lust. The book and the film depict Christ being tempted by imagining himself engaged in sexual activities, which caused outrage from certain Christian groups, claiming the work as blasphemy. It includes a disclaimer saying, "This film is not based on the Gospels, but upon the fictional exploration of the eternal spiritual conflict." Okay, so what I would say there is, when it shows Jesus Christ engaged in sexual activity, it shows him marrying Mary and going on to have a family. So it's not showing him engaged so much in fornication as in the process of doing that to have a family. That's the way I interpreted it, but I might be wrong. So that was The Last Temptation of Christ. And again, it's not a film that I really raved about in any manner whatsoever. 1990's Goodfellas, my favourite Scorsese film. I can't, the amount of times when I was at university from 91 to 94 that I would go to the, if I'd have known how many times I was going to hire it out from the video shop, I would have been better off just buying it. You know, it was crazy. But this is billed as Three Decades of Life in the Mafia, and it's the real mafia film. Now, I like the Godfather films. I think they're very well done, but they're about the Godfather. They're about the head of a family, okay? Now, if you want to watch a film about the police, would you watch a film about the chief constable or the chief of police about the police? You wouldn't, would you? All the films and TV about police are about the people on the streets. Well, that's what this Goodfellas is about, and it's based upon the actual account by Henry Hill, writing with Nicholas Pileggi, about his time in the Mafia and then going into the witness protection program, what have you. And it's a fascinating story. And all sorts of ups and downs that happens in that life. It's almost like a documentary, if you like, on it. It's not done in that style. But if you like any sort of mafia gangster type film, that always has to be the top of anyone's list. And The Sopranos, I think David Chase said, couldn't have existed without Goodfellas. And indeed, many of the characters in Goodfellas ended up in, even in the smallest roles in The Sopranos. It was almost like he was trying to tick off the cast as I'm trying to tick off the Scorsese films here and get as many people on as he possibly could from that film. That takes us on to 1991's Cape Fear, which was a remake of the original. And the original had, the lead roles were Robert Mitchum and Gregory Peck, and they appear in minor roles here. But the lead roles are Nick Nolte and Robert De Niro. And Robert De Niro plays some psychotic guy who blames his lawyer, played by Nick Nolte, for not revealing certain evidence about the promiscuity of a girl he was accused of raping and doing horrible things to as well, which would have either gotten him off a prison sentence or certainly got him a lighter one if they revealed that she was promiscuous. And it was something that his lawyer knew about, but because what he did to this girl, he chose not to present it to his client De Niro or to the court. And De Niro subsequently finds out when he's in prison. Nick Nolte can't understand how he would know that, because he said the guy was illiterate, but while he was in prison, he learned to read, and then he started to read law books, and then he started to find stuff out, and that was one of the things that he found out. And he subsequently terrorises Nick Nolte and his family through the film. It's a very good thriller. It's got some very unpleasant scenes in it. If you're squeamish, I wouldn't watch it. But essentially, that was another film I used to watch a lot. It was in my De Niro phase. He was my favourite actor, that type of thing, when you're an impressionable 18, 19 year old, something like that, 20. The Age of Innocence. Now, I saw that yesterday morning. I say saw, that's 1993, follows on from 1991's Cape Fear. That is something that never interested me. That's why it took me 33 years to watch it, okay? It stars Daniel Day-Lewis, Winona Ryder, and Michelle Pfeiffer, and a few people pop up that wasn't expected, like Richard E. Grant is in there, and in minor roles. Different people, but it's all about socialites in 1880s New York. And I started watching it, and I was quite surprised, because I was sort of having a breakfast at the time, so I was sort of half watching it, things like that. And I ended up about 20-25 minutes in before I decided to fast forward. And what I did was I just put it on one times play, so I could see all the imagery and I could stop on anything. What I can tell you about the film is not just the way the costumes and the backgrounds and the rooms that are filmed in, and even the food, it's done. It looks so wonderful. You just want to dive in there and help yourself, that sort of thing. So the imagery is excellent. But I'm just not interested in a period drama from 1880s New York with a guy who's basically gets involved with one woman and marries her, but he secretly desires another. And what goes on, that sort of thing. So it was just one of the remaining two to kick off the list that I ordered earlier in the week, and they arrived. I had to go back to ordering online, much as I hate it, because some films, when you go to charity shops, it's almost like, oh, we don't put that one out, we put that on the internet. You think they don't do it for things worth say, £10 and above, but they'll do it. Some of them will do it for films worth £4 or £5. You think by the time they've paid the commission and all the other, you know, handling of the staff on it, it'd be cheaper to put it out for £1 or £2 in the shop, wouldn't it? But that's not how a lot of people think in these shops, unfortunately. So certain things you do have to go online and buy. So that's The Age of Innocence. 1995's Casino. Now, that was a film really looked forward to. One thing I didn't mention about Goodfellas is it took the Joe Pesci and the Frank Vincent from Raging Bull, and they were again lead characters in Goodfellas. And they again pop up in Casino. So these, the De Niro, Frank Vincent, Joe Pesci together. Very interesting combination. They work well. This again is written by, excuse me, Nicholas Pileggi, but this is based upon a couple of accounts. You've got a guy called Frank Colotta, and he actually had a show on YouTube. It's called Coffee with Colotta, and I've got all the episodes. He died not so long ago, and they're very, very interesting what he gets into. And he talks a lot about the film Casino, because he became a technical advisor on the film. And it's also based upon Frank Rosenthal, who was a manager of a casino over in Vegas in the 60s, 70s, that was sort of mob controlled. And it's that story, and it's kind of the tail end of the mob running the casinos of Las Vegas before they all went corporate. And again, it's a fascinating tale. Again, it's like a documentary. There's some very horrible scenes in, like one guy gets his head put in a vice until he reveal some information, unpleasant things such as that. But as a narrative story, what have you, it's very, very well done. And it, for me, it's up there with Goodfellas. It's one of his very best films. That takes us on to 1997's Kundun. Now, I only know this from a later film we'll get into, but he described The Last Temptation of Christ as becoming his first in a religious trilogy. Now, the second is 1997's Kundun, which again I saw yesterday. I say saw because I watched a bit of it. It's about the life of the current Dalai Lama, how he was selected and what he went through up to his exile from Tibet. He wasn't necessarily exiled. He left, but he's never been allowed to go back since because the Chinese don't like him. And it's his life story to that point in those years. And this is described as Scorsese's second religious film. But it's very much pro-Buddhism, pro-Tibet, pro-the Dalai Lama, pro all these views. Whereas The Last Temptation of Christ, it didn't follow the Gospels at all. It tried to tell you different things about Jesus Christ that aren't real. But this instead, when it comes to Buddhism, he wants to be faithful to the story. So I have to, we'll get back to that later. But again, if you're interested, I again watched it one time's play. The imagery was amazing. I think it was filmed in Morocco again. Beautiful imagery in the film. Very well done in that sense. But I'm just not interested in the story of the Dalai Lama. But I'd love to hear Brian Rue, who's a Buddhist, he's a friend I haven't spoken to many years, but I'd love to hear his view on it if he's seen the film, because he would know, he'd be the person to ask about something like that, because not only is he a Buddhist, but he was a Buddhist teacher. He lived in a Buddhist monastery in Thailand even for a while. I think he's based in Canada, and he still broadcasts, but I think he talks more about UFOs, things like that now. Okay, that takes us on to 1999's Bringing Out the Dead, which I've owned a couple of times on DVD, and it's, let me put, because I'm probably better off reading from the Wikipedia description, because it didn't mean much to me, but it should have done, because it had, well, I'll read it to you. Bringing Out the Dead is a 1999 American psychological drama film directed by Martin Scorsese and written by Paul Schrader. He also wrote Taxi Driver, by the way, based on the 1998 novel by Joe Connolly. It stars Nicolas Cage, Patricia Arquette, John Goodman, Ving Rhames and Tom Sizemore. The plot depicts 48 hours in the life of a depressed New York City paramedic who's played by Nicolas Cage. It just didn't grip me. I just wasn't a fun watch. I mean, there's some bits, I think Cage goes off, he's taking drugs and all this sort of stuff. It just didn't interest me. It's something on the surface you look at and you think, well, you know, some Nicolas Cage, John Goodman, Tom Sizemore, you know. These are all actors that I can recall. I mean, John Goodman, The Big Lebowski, Tom Sizemore, excellent role in Natural Born Killers. I mean, Nicolas Cage, you take your pick, he's been in so many interesting films. But Bring Out the Dead is not a film that was of interest to me. 48 hours in the life of a depressed paramedic in New York City, if you want to watch it. Worth a watch, you may like it. For me, it's not something I will be going back to. We go on to Gangs of New York, which brought Daniel Day-Lewis, who was in The Age of Innocence, back as a lead role. And I remember Scorsese saying about this that he wanted an actor who would know how to portray the pain of a central character. And it goes back, I think, to the 1800s, and you had the Five Points in New York, and you had these different gangs from each area, and they would fight it out. And what annoyed me when this came out, and I may be right, I may be wrong, but there's... Let me check the actress. Is it Cameron Diaz? Yeah, it is. I've got it here. It almost seemed like it was another gangster film set in the 1800s, but he had a love story in there between Leonardo DiCaprio and Cameron Diaz in order to get audience that would be interested in the love story aspect as well. And I felt that was like selling out. But it's supposed to be based on a book, so if that is in the book, then obviously I was wrong. If that's not, then you can make your own judgment. But I found it to be interesting to watch, but it didn't really grip me. It's not something that I go back to again, like I would Casino or Goodfellas, which for me are a classic Scorsese. The other interesting thing about it is this was filmed in Italy, and the actor, British actor who I like, Stephen Graham, had a role in it. He was part of, I believe, Leonardo DiCaprio's gang, and you see him pop up quite a bit. And I believe he was a TV actor at the time over here in the UK. I mean, what an opportunity to be able to go out to Italy and be in a Scorsese film. But the set that they used ended up being used for The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson in a few years later, because it was still up there. And they found by changing a few bits, rather than building everything from scratch, they could adapt this to fit in with biblical times for The Passion of the Christ. So you're talking about the same set was used for Gangs of New York and The Passion of the Christ. Another useless factor for you there. We go on a couple of years later to 2004's The Aviator. This is another biopic film. It's about the life of Howard Hughes, who was a famous... He inherited all this money from his father, who was in a company, not necessarily oil as such, but they invented these drill bits that were used in oil drilling, made an absolute fortune. And consequently, the fortune passed to him, and he became something of a playboy. He started off doing films and... Excuse me. I don't know what is wrong with my throat today. It's absolutely ridiculous. I'm sorry about this. So anyway, The Aviator, about Howard Hughes, and essentially he had this money from his father's business, went into films for a while, dated all these different starlets everywhere, real playboy about town, ended up becoming interested in planes. I think he bought TWA, but he also worked on inventing planes. So he had this big wooden plane called the Spruce Goose, which could only get a few feet off the water. And it focused all on that part of his life rather than what I'd be more interested in was the reclusive years when, you know, he would live on the whole floor of a casino, rent the whole floor to himself. He wouldn't leave, you know. Members of staff had to pass him things in tissue paper. He was a real germaphobe, stuff like that. And what happened in his life then, but that's only briefly touched upon at the end. And so it's an interesting story about him. I just felt that it should have concentrated more on the mysterious aspects of his life rather than the aspects that we already knew about. That takes us to 2006's The Departed, which went back to the gangster genre. And in this focused in, you know, on Irish gangs. So we're talking like the Westies, Boston, that type of thing was really what influenced it. And it was the one that Scorsese finally got an Oscar for, Best Director. And I think it was probably a career Oscar rather than for that particular film. But you would have to look at the competition for that year, which I haven't done. Not my favourite film. It's worth watching. He's got Jack Nicholson in it, in the lead role. Leonardo DiCaprio again. Many people believe that Leonardo DiCaprio replaced sort of De Niro as his lead actor of choice, as De Niro was getting older and couldn't play these sorts of roles anymore. But essentially, you've got a corrupt cop, and you've got another cop that goes undercover to find out what's going on, and it's an investigation of police corruption and these different gang things that go on. It doesn't have the drama and execution of a Goodfellas or a Casino. It's an interesting story, but it's not quite there for me. It was fun seeing Ray Winston acting as Jack Nicholson's henchman. I never imagined I would see Ray Winston and Jack Nicholson acting together, and it's a film well worth a watch. But again, how many times have I seen it? Maybe a couple of times. I would much rather go back to one of the films I mentioned earlier. But one film that is one of the best Scorsese films is coming up next, 2010, Shutter Island. This is an amazing film. I saw it at the cinema. And it's about a mental hospital on an island and a guy in there. And you can't, even at the end of the film, it's what he believes that he, let's see what they, because I can't really put this into words properly and I don't want to give anything away. Let's go to its Wikipedia page. The film follows Deputy US Marshal Edward Teddy Daniels and his partner Chuck, who come to the fictional Shutter Island in Boston Harbor to investigate its criminal psychiatric facility after one of its patients goes missing. Daniels has his own ulterior motives for taking the case. And it's much more. It develops. You think that you're watching a couple of police officers investigating a psychiatric facility, and as the film goes on, there's twists in it that you're just not expecting. If you haven't seen it, I can't recommend this highly enough. This is a really, really, really good thriller. It's not particularly bloody or anything like that, so I don't think it would upset too many people. If you haven't seen a Scorsese film, I would seriously consider this one. I suppose it's a bit overlong, 138 minutes. I like to think that more on the 90 minute mark, but with Scorsese you're always going to really be looking at around the 2 hour mark generally with a film of his. Highly recommended. 2011, Hugo. I can't tell you the amount of times I saw this in a charity shop and never picked it up. It was a U-rated film, which incidentally The Age of Innocence was as well. But it seemed to be aimed at children. And all I remember is it was sort of centred around a train station. It had Sacha Baron Cohen in the lead role. And I couldn't work out what the guy out of Borat was doing in the lead role of a Scorsese film. But apparently it tells the story of a boy who lives alone in the Gare Montparnasse railway station in Paris in the 1930s. Only to become embroiled in a mystery surrounding his late father's automaton. And, different machines in it that I just didn't really find of great interest. Another one I fast-forwarded through. Visually stunning, but I'm just not interested in the story of a boy who lives alone in a railway station in Paris in the 1930s. And it was just something that I picked up just to say that I had seen it. Excuse me. This takes us on to 2013's The Wolf of Wall Street, which has very unpleasant scenes in, but can be a lot of fun if you're prepared to put up with the sex and the language and the drugs and all that sort of stuff that is apparently all true. It's based upon a guy, it's on the tip of my tongue. He was a Wall Street dealer. He got hold of some sort of old company and started selling pretty much worthless stocks on it because he was able to get away with it. And, you know, in real life, if you'd have bought those and lost your life savings, I don't think you'd find this particularly amusing. But the way that it's executed as a film is quite an amusing watch. It's Jordan Belfort is the guy that it's based on. His career as a stockbroker in New York City and how his firm Stratton Oakmont engaged in rampant corruption and fraud on Wall Street. So you've got Leonardo DiCaprio in the main role again. It's his fifth film that he did with Martin Scorsese. And it's just no holds barred debauchery. I mean, this guy's got more money than he knows how to spend. And he ends up just, you know, involved with drugs and prostitutes and, you know, ends up having a downfall at the end, as so many of the lead characters do in Martin Scorsese films. So worth a watch, that one. And there's a very interesting scene with Matthew McConaughey at the start, who plays a very odd character that was improvising with Leonardo DiCaprio, and he said he just had to go along with it. He didn't know what on earth the guy was doing, but he didn't want to ruin the scene, so he went along with it. And I think that they used the improvisations that he did. They're really quite entertaining. So all about corruption on Wall Street in the 1980s, and quite an interesting film, and one that I could relate to having grown up in that time. Okay, if I can get to the right page, I will. I've got to go back here. This takes us to 2016 Silence, which I saw a week or two ago. Now, this is supposed to be the third film of the trilogy that Scorsese did on religious films, following the first one being The Last Temptation of Christ in 88, the second one being Kundun in, what was that, 97, and this one, 2016, Silence. And what this is about is you've got a couple of Christian missionaries, I believe they're Catholic missionaries actually, and they go over to Japan. And Japan are known for torturing missionaries until they recant their belief in Jesus Christ. And the message of the film is that missionaries end up having to recant the name of Jesus Christ because God never came to their need, to their aid when they needed them. So they're out there, the message is, they're out there trying to spread the word of God. So why would any God allow them to be treated the way that they're treated when he's trying to spread their word? So again, it's causing doubt in the minds of, you know, why would you believe in a God who allows this to happen to his missionaries? That's really the message I got from the film. So I'm left confused as to why, when Scorsese covers a Buddhist subject, he seems faithful to its official history, but when he covers something to do with Christianity, he always seems to look for some sort of way of undermining it. Now, he says that he was originally going to be a priest before he decided to become a filmmaker. Did something happen in his life, and he's, you know, been very annoyed with ever since? Was he badly treated by the church, and is that why he likes to make films that cast question marks over aspects of Christianity? Or is it just his choice of filmmaking? I don't know. I don't know the man. But I just find it strange that the films he did, as I say, on Christianity, seem to look at ways of questioning the religion, whereas the religious film on Buddhism stays faithful to its core beliefs. That film, Overlong, I won't be watching it again. And it takes us on to 2019's The Irishman, which for me was his last great film. Unfortunately, it's supposed to be based, it is based upon a true account of someone who was a hitman. The trouble is, and he wrote a book called I Heard You Paint Houses about his life as a hitman. The trouble is that there's been many occasions since that he's been found out to be just completely making the whole thing up. And again, it takes us back to people like Frank Carlotta. He talks about He said to Scorsese, I think he said he contacted him, or someone involved in that film, he said, you know, why are you doing this film? Don't you know this guy's just making the whole thing up? I think his name's Frank Sheeran. And so when you watch the film, whereas Casino and Goodfellas, any Hollywood film, they're always going to take something and do something else with it. It's always based on, because sometimes they can make things more interesting by making things up. And I mean, I would question whether Henry Hill, he always maintains he never killed anybody. Well, when you look at all the things he was involved in, do you really think that guy never actually did? I mean, I remember Tony Sirico, who played Paulie in The Sopranos, one of the lead characters, and he was a proper, he'd been in prison, he was involved in organised crime. And there's a film, it's a documentary about 1989 where he's being interviewed, and he's talking about his life as, you know, being involved in crime. And at one point the interviewer says, did you ever kill anybody? He just goes, did I what? You know, like, but there's a point in that interview where he's talking about there was a sailor who was trying to hit on his girlfriend and he went mad and beat him up and threw him in the harbour and never saw him again. Well, did that guy survive or was he involved in something else? Of course, one thing that Frank Carlotta says is he actually talks about murders he was involved in, actually carried out. In fact, Nicholas Pileggi makes the point on the Casino film that he doesn't believe there's been any time in history where a technical advisor to a film is actually telling them how to film a murder that he committed. Because, you see, when he went into a government witness program, his deal was that those murders, he admitted to them, and I think he might have been given a little time somewhere, but he could still talk about them because they'd been dealt with by that deal he'd done with the government. Now, if Henry Hill had done a deal with the government, but he'd been involved in a murder years before, and that deal didn't cover that murder, well, they could still go after him for that. And that's something that's been talked about by people like Michael Franzese as well on his YouTube channel, about what you can talk about, what you can't, as a former mafia person. But that, I don't know why I went over there, but my point being is, but those stories, Casino and Goodfellas, were still largely true stories, because I've read the books that go with them as well. All right, they might have been putting stuff in there too. But the Frank Sheeran, I Heard You Paint Houses, filmed as The Irishman, it always had that bad taste in my mouth that it was supposed to be the third one, if you like, after Goodfellas and Casino. Because again, you had Joe Pesci come back. Frank Vincent wasn't in it because I think he passed away. So you had Joe Pesci and De Niro as leads. Al Pacino was brought in as Jimmy Hoffa, which was very interesting. It's the first time I'd seen Al Pacino in a Scorsese film. And it was a good film, and I saw it a couple of times, and I will watch it again. It was very well done. But as I say, it's just that underlying thing about it supposedly being true and doesn't sound like it is. Takes us on to his last film, 2023, Killers of the Flower Moon. Now, this was difficult to get, as was The Irishman, because The Irishman was filmed for Netflix, and I won't subscribe to Netflix. If I had to get Netflix, I'd have to get a TV license as well, because you have to have a TV license to watch TV, and you have to have a TV to get Netflix. So it all goes together, any sort of streaming that you can get, something like that. It's I had to wait for what seemed like ages. Firstly, for it to come out, because it had been worked on for years. But what had happened is they had to de-age the characters, like De Niro and Pacino. They had the technology that they could do to de-age them, but it cost a hell of a lot of money. And the original backers didn't want to pay it, so it kind of got left for a while. And then I think Netflix came in, they said they'd pay it. But they were keeping it on Netflix. For example, there's a Ricky Gervais comedy called Afterlife. And I mean, that's run its, I think, what, three series it did? And you can't even get series one. It's all just, nothing ever been released on DVD. All just stuck on Netflix. And so a lot of these people are going to keep hold of it. And so people just end up getting their subscription, hopefully staying for good. I'm not going to be one of those people. But The Criterion Collection finally released it on Blu-ray, and I purchased a copy. And as I say, it's worth seeing. It's a guy who claimed to be this hitman. He claimed to be involved in the hit on Jimmy Hoffa and hits on other people as well, like the Joey Gallo, stuff like that. But one thing I did notice, there's a point in the film where Robert De Niro beats up a shopkeeper. Now, he's got to be in his late 70s by this point, I would have thought, when he was filming this film. And he's sort of kicking the guy around, but he's very wooden as he does it. Because he, you know, he's an action, trying to do an action scene at that age is going to be difficult. So he sort of pulls his shopkeeper out of his shop and he's kicking him around on the ground and stuff, and it just doesn't look realistic. Not that I enjoy watching things of that nature, but I'm just saying that that was something that I noticed. Killers of the Flower Moon, 2023, which was his last film, is about Native American Indians and how the American population, wealthy landowners and stuff, were basically doing very nasty things to them in order to get their land, which had various minerals and that on it. And it's got Robert De Niro and Leonardo DiCaprio in it for the first time together since 1993's This Boy's Life, which I didn't enjoy as a film. Funnily enough, that's not true. They did a promotional film for a hotel in Macau, I believe, in 2015, where they were both arguing about who Martin Scorsese was going to hire as an actor for the next role. So it was sort of done like comedy. It's only about 15, 18 minutes. You can probably find it online. I think I saw it there. It's quite amusing. Brad Pitt pops up towards the end as well. Funnily enough, after Kundun came out, the Chinese government was so annoyed with Scorsese that they said that he was permanently banned from China or their territories, but he was allowed to go to Macau to view this film, and that's part of Chinese territory, I believe, so it appears that the ban was lifted. So anyway, Killers of the Flower Moon, it focuses on this story here, and when's it set? I think it's set in the early 1920s Oklahoma. It focuses on a series of murders of Osage members and relations in the Osage Nation after oil was discovered on their on tribal land. The tribal members had retained mineral rights on their reservation, but a corrupt local political boss sought to steal the wealth. So that is what the film is about, and I was right. It was dedicated to Robbie Robertson, who died a couple of months before the film's release. So there you go. Now, this film, it's interesting because this was done for... I pressed the wrong button again. This was done for Paramount Pictures and Apple TV. But the only place I could find it to buy was out of Italy. There's a company in Italy that's involved in it, so they released it on Blu-ray. And the only other film I had to do that with to get on Blu-ray was Once Upon a Time in America. So you get all the artwork of that, like Once Upon a Time in America, but it's written, it's got the same lettering, but it's written in Italian. But it all plays in English and stuff like that, as did Killers of the Flower Moon. I've seen it once. It cost me quite a lot of money, probably about 20 quid or so to get it over here. And I've not viewed it since, and I've got no plans to. It's worth watching, but it's not one of his best films, Scorsese's, or for that matter, De Niro's or DiCaprio's. I'll get there one day. DiCaprio's best film as an actor was Blood Diamond. As a story, it was probably The Wolf of Wall Street, but his acting in Blood Diamond is just really good, and that's from Peter Hammond's mouth as well. And Leonardo DiCaprio plays a South African there, and for Peter Hammond, who's a South African himself, to say he got the voice right and things like that, it's a testament to DiCaprio's performance. So that takes us on to his last film, which has not been released. Okay, so it's called What Happens at Night. Now, I don't think it's going to come out for a couple of years, and I'll explain why quickly. Killers of the Flower Moon, it's principal photography, so that's when they finish filming everything. And then they go into a studio to do the editing, the music, all this sort of stuff that they do to it. That finished in October 2021, on Killers of the Flower Moon, but it wasn't released until October 2023. Now, this film, What Happens at Night, it says the principal photography finished in May, I believe, of 2026 this year. So, if it follows the same... No, it says here, filming, on May 29th, it was reported that the film was now in post-production, and it started filming on February the 24th of this year in the Czech Republic. So, if it takes as long to come to the screen after the filming's finished as Killers of the Flower Moon did, then I wouldn't expect to see it until 2028. But the film is about, it says here, it's a gothic psychological horror film. The premise is a married American couple travel to a small, snowy European town to adopt a baby. As they struggle to claim their baby, they seem to know less about themselves. So, Leonardo DiCaprio is the lead role, just called the man, Jennifer Lawrence as the woman, and then Mads Mikkelsen as brother Emmanuel. Mads Mikkelsen played the Hannibal Lecter character in the Hannibal Lecter television series, and he did it very, very well. So it'd be interesting to see him in a film. Patricia Clarkson's in it. I remember her from the Deadpool. She's the kind of romantic interest of Clint Eastwood in the final Dirty Harry film. What was that? 88, I believe. And Jared Harris, who is Richard Harris's son, and he's a very interesting character. He's film commentary on the film The Ward from 2010 that he did for John Carpenter, which was John Carpenter's final film. He's one of the most entertaining film commentaries that I've ever heard. And he's a good actor. He's in a miniseries called Chernobyl, which is just a fantastic series and a great performance by him. So it'd be interesting to see this film when it comes out. But I wouldn't imagine that to be anytime soon. But you never know. Maybe it's not as complicated as Killers of the Flower Moon was, and it might come out sooner rather than later. Roger Corman speed, you know, film it and release it a few weeks later. We will just have to wait and see. But that brings us to the end of the films of Martin Scorsese. So I hope I haven't bored you. I see I've been going on for more than an hour, but I just had to get in what I got in. I hope if you haven't seen them, it's given you some ideas of what you want to see and what you don't. But what I presented to you today is not the subject I'm best known for, but after having had my God-given right to free speech stolen from me by the very people who are supposed to protect it, it has been a joy to be able to speak freely on this subject today. It is not until I did it that I realised how much I missed it. If you enjoyed this episode of Andrew Carrington Hitchcock Presents and have the financial wherewithal to do so, then please support the show by clicking the blue donate button at andrewcarringtonhitchcock.com. The more donations I get, the more shows you get. And in the meantime, thank you for listening and bye for now. Okay, I don't know if anyone will be listening to this bit. I don't think I've done this before, done something after the show, closing music. But I've got two DVDs on my desk here, so I didn't forget. The Last Waltz on the top, because it's not in the list of the Martin Scorsese either on his Wikipedia page in the filmography section. And I should have put the DVD underneath it on top, so I wouldn't have forgotten. Between The Last Temptation of Christ and Goodfellas, in 1989, a film came out called New York Stories, and it's three directors who each do like a 30-40 minute segment, and the first one is by Martin Scorsese. Here's from the back of the DVD cover. Nick Nolte stars in this passionate tale of a world-famous painter torn between his obsession for his art and his infatuation with his sultry but unresponsive assistant played by Rosanna Arquette. The next one is Life Without Zoe. This is directed by Francis Ford Coppola. Talia Shire and Giancarlo Giannini star in this whimsical fantasy as the childlike parents of Zoe, a very grown-up 12-year-old girl who brings charm and magic to life in New York. And the third one, Oedipus Rex, directed by Woody Allen. It's about a neurotic lawyer who cannot escape the one woman who looms large in his life, his mother, played by Mae Questa. Mio Farah and Julie Kavner star as the other women who further complicate his situation. Now, I'm largely in agreement from many of the critics if you look at the Wikipedia page for New York Stories. Life Lessons by Martin Scorsese is a very well done film. Nick Nolte just plays this painter, just really, it's just 40 minutes, it's good. Steve Buscemi pops up in it as well. And it turns out the bit that he does was actually written by himself. So this is Steve Buscemi pre-Reservoir Dogs. I mean, I thought Reservoir Dogs and In the Soup were like his first films, but he popped up here. Life Without Zoe, the Francis Ford Coppola segment, is widely regarded as bad. And I would have to agree. I watched all of Life Lessons, the Martin Scorsese segment. I tried to watch Life Without Zoe and gave it a few minutes, but it was just so awful I had to fast forward through that. And then Oedipus Rex, the Woody Allen segment. I mean, there's things in it. He's like this neurotic guy and he takes his girlfriend to meet his mother, and he hates his mother being anywhere with him because she always embarrasses him. And so, you know, his mother says, oh yeah, he used to wet the bed and all that, and he's got his head in his hands, why do you have to tell people this sort of stuff? There was this one scene, I saw this yesterday, I actually planned to watch it all, but as I say, I fast forwarded through the Francis Ford Coppola segment, but I watched the other two after I'd seen, fast forwarded through rather, The Age of Innocence and Kundun. But his mother turns up at his office when he's in a big business meeting with all the bigwigs, and he sees her arriving, and he's just horrified, and she's got this woman with him, her friend with her, and she's there talking to him. She says, yeah, we went to see Cats. He said, you went to see Mr. Cats? And suddenly I notice from behind his mother's friend's handbag, there's the program of Cats with Cats written on there. No, we went to see the musical Cats, and that was quite funny. It's quite amusing, the first, but then it sort of goes a bit weird. And even Roger Ebert, in the write-up to the film, he said the first half is just excellent, but then it loses its way. And I think that's the case. But certainly I would watch for the first segment and the third segment on New York Stories, and that's well worth a watch as well. So I apologise to any of you who won't hear this, because if you're like me, the closing music plays and that's when I tune out. But I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to bring it up when I'm talking about something completely different. It was easier to add it on to the end here. So hopefully people will see, who generally see the closing music's only about a minute and a half when it starts playing, that there's obviously something going on afterwards and you hear it there. So thanks again for listening. Have a wonderful day, and bye for now.